Hello and welcome to the eighth episode of the Nonstop Podcast with Pooja. Welcome, Maria. It's lovely to have you.
Thank you, Pooja. I just have to say that I know my name is Maria Juliana, and I'm coming from Latin America. Everybody is Maria, so I didn't tell you that, but I usually go by the name Juliana or Maria Juliana. So you can call me Juliana because I'm usually like everybody calls me like that.
Yeah, you know, I practiced Juliana like at least 10 times today because I know that I'm going to have this call with you, and then I was a bit nervous, so I kind of like restricted myself to Maria. So firstly, Juliana, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and being my eighth guest, and such a crucial guest for me. Just a little bit of background for those who are listening to us today. So Maria Juliana is a Ministry of Foreign Affairs minister, and she represents Colombian government with the United Nations, and as a ministry to counselor, I assume, for health and nutrition related like issues, and also works closely with World Health Organizations and other institutions which are very vital for health and statistics related to that. I assume that I've given a gist of it, but I think it's going to be more impressive that you tell me from your words who you are and what you do.
Okay, thank you, Pusha, and thank you for inviting me. Okay, I'm Juliana. I come from Colombia, and as you said, I'm part of the foreign service of my country. So I'm a diplomat, and I'm a lawyer as my background. So in terms of I know the positions in the diplomatic career are not very familiar to everybody. So basically, minister counselor means that I'm not a minister in my country, but I'm just ranked in as minister counselor in the diplomatic career. That is more or less like the middle to the top, like in the different ranks of the diplomatic career. So I am posted in Geneva, and I'm currently following all WHO related matters, so in the health portfolio. But basically, what I have done in my entire life is basically legal issues and of course some multilateral issues. So that's it.
Yeah, I mean, I know you say that that's it, but it's very interesting, at least from my point of view, to just hear that you work as a diplomat and you work with United Nations. These are two big things and two big words to comprise your ranking. my first question would be, on a very simple terms, what does your everyday look like at the United Nations, and what do you do?
Okay, so basically, and this applies, I think, for any diplomat. So that is dealing with multilateral issues. So first, what is a multilateral issue? Is, as you said, like joining with these conversations within international organizations, such as the UN or the UN system, like WHO. So basically, we our daily lives is like daily day would be like any other person that works in an office. So we have to see emails, we need to respond to questions and so on. But the big difference here is that we receive instructions from our capital. So basically, we have to transform the instruction from our capital into concrete actions in those international organizations. So when we are at the mission, so in the office, we're just running through documents and emails and different things that we need to prepare in order to be able to have the conversation in the scenario of the international organization. And whenever we are in the international organization, basically what we said are statements. So those statements are pretty much basically prepared statements on the different issues. So if we're dealing with pandemics, so we need to prepare statements on that. And then we represent the voice of Colombia in that international organization. But of course, if it's a multilateral organization, we need to talk to each other. So the other part of the conversation is not a formatted speech, but millions of conversations between different delegates that represent other countries, other interests, trying to reach a consensus on one issue. So that means talking and hearing and trying to find middle ground in order to reach consensus on the different topics that the international organization deals with.
Yeah, that's a very simply put terms of the mammoth of tasks that you go through on a day-to-day basis. I also know that you are very reverbed and you're very acclaimed and renowned in the area of work that you do. So my next question is going to be a little more on, so you work very closely with health and nutrition and things like that. Having looked upon you, be obvious. I mean, I've come to also understanding that you work with Institute of International Sustainable Development. You've represented Colombia before these institutions, and what really is the goal behind this? Like, what is your whole agenda behind working with the health, the statistics, especially with Latin America, like representing Colombia. What is that we do not know on a whole? Because as of now, just as a general consumer of television or social media or just even like information, we do understand there is like health statistics that the World Health Organization releases from time to time, and then we understand that there are so many kids that are deprived of food, nutrition, etc., etc. So in your agenda of things, how does the integration of Colombian government and health statistics come into play?
Okay, well, thank you for the question. I'm just gonna speak in broader terms. So right now I'm dealing with health and I'm representing Colombia before the WHO. So that means, and in terms of the of diplomacy, we talk about portfolios. So which is interesting because it's like using the terms that private sector uses. So I'm dealing with the health portfolio, but I'm a diplomat from a developing country. So basically, being a diplomat from a developing country means that we need to go from one issue to another because we don't have sufficient people to cover all of the issues. So I was dealing in the past with environmental issues and law of the sea issues, and now I'm dealing with health issues. But what the common thing about these three is that they're permeated, like they have this cross-cutting issue of international law. So basically, what I've tried to do is try to apply the international law perspective into the different areas. And that's my approach. So in terms of like trying to explain like in more common terms to people what we do, so the common understanding of people is that diplomats are the persons who go to cocktails and usually have fun, like in foreign countries, earning a good salary. And going to these parties, which I'm not saying that is not true. So we do have to go to attend cocktails and ceremonies and so on. And we of course need to be posted in cities abroad because those are the places where negotiations take place. But our daily work is very hard because we need to study issues in order to not only understand the issue, but also to try to defend our country's position. And as I said, Colombia's interests could match the other country's interests, but in some cases they don't match. So we need to come to an understanding. And that is with 183 states. So that is hard. So I'm not going to answer precisely the question about the health statistics because that is very much related with the health portfolio. But in general, what diplomats do is just try to identify what are the interests of your country in a particular issue. For example, I'm dealing with a pandemic treaty negotiation. So in terms to prepare for the next pandemic, what do we need to do? And what Colombia needs to be better prepared for the next pandemic? And then trying to translate that interest in actual terms into the negotiation and try to convey that message to the rest of the world. And just because we need to come to an agreement. Multilateralism is not about voting. Like voting is the last resource. So that means you need to convince 183 countries. So basically, that's it. So how we do that? Of course, we do that through conversations, but also through having coffees and also through having different receptions. But within those means, it's when we get to talk to other delegations and try to understand their concerns, our concerns, and try to reach common ground.
And those who do not have a law background and are listening to this because they're curious, what a diplomat actually does. In most countries, especially like from where I come from, India, diplomats are of very high ranking, and it's very hard to for me to strike a conversation with a diplomat of your ranking and just truly understand from a standpoint what you do at work every day. So firstly, I'm privileged that I'm having this conversation and I'm providing this kind of insights to anybody who is potentially listening to this podcast. But also, it will be only fair if I just deep dive into a little bit. So for those who are not in laws and who do not agree or understand the technicalities behind what goes in the United Nations scope of work as a diplomat. So you get in touch with these diplomats from different countries on an open forum, say for example, a general assembly, and then there are different agendas passed on based on your portfolio. You come together and you get them to agree, and then you sign a treaty, a multilateral treaty or a bilateral treaty, depending on what the subject matter is. And that is in fact enforced within the countries as domestic laws. Am I right in understanding this?
Yes, you're right. That's part of what we do within international organizations. So you can, of course, work with legally binding instruments. Those are the treaties that you mentioned. That they could be multilateral or bilateral. But we also have another, like some other set of tools that are not legally binding. So those are called, it depends on the organization, but those are usually called resolutions, regulations, decisions. So you in under international law, you have two set of things, legally and non-legally binding. And in terms of the legally binding instruments, of course, you need to domesticate those international instruments. So that would be according to your domestic system. For example, in my country, so we need to have a law and a revision of our constitutional court of every international treaty that we signed on before we can ratify it. But in other countries, just to go to the parliament and that's it. Or there are other agreements that for some countries they you can apply them directly. But of course, in international law, you always need to domesticate the commitments in order to be applicable in your national context. That goes also for the non-legally binding instruments. So if you want to implement them, so you need to have the domestic developments in order to be able to implement them. But so you're correct. So we need to transpose these international commitments into domestic developments.
Yeah, and I also will be at fault if I don't deep dive into like social economic aspect of things, like just for this to become more interesting than two lawyers speaking on a podcast. So tell us, Maria, like how is the situation, for example, in Colombia right now? You are on portfolio that work with pandemic negotiations on future pandemic prospective areas that that could happen to a country, either medically or like I assume in terms of other act of God or nature. I would also like to also ask you about the different areas of work that you did work with health and nutrition, and what kind of arguments do you present when it comes to such portfolio topics, or if you want to tell us something that has been very exciting for you that you presented on behalf of Latin America on a very specific topic that is of a public importance, and you were totally appalled by, another developed country and how much protection they had, both in terms of like nationalistic protection in terms of government, but also in terms of like well-being of people. Is there a huge parity between, for example, countries like Latin America to other delegations and their responses in such sensitive topics?
Okay, thank you again for that question. So I need to clarify something that I didn't say at the beginning. So I'm speaking as Juliana, so not as an official from my government. So I'm not explaining my country's views on anything. But that being said, so I there are some things that are exciting about my job because I have the opportunity and the privilege and honor to represent 48 million country 48 million people in my country that I'm representing. So I feel it like that way. That I'm representing the interests of the Colombian people. And what I'm trying to do is just have better opportunities for the Colombian people. And so I once did participate in some talk that how to compare diplomats and I try to compare them to compare us to the football national team. So I know in India cricket is like the most popular sport. So in my country it's football or soccer for the people in the US. And so we're very passionate about football and wearing the national jersey, the t-shirt, so that the wearing those colors and so on. So and people demand many from their players. So if we lose, it's like, why didn't you play well? Why didn't you represent your country very well? So basically, we're like that. Like diplomats are like basically a part of the national team of our countries, and for that reason, we put our hearts out in every process that we participate. And that's what I wanted to say, that of course there's a difference between developed country diplomats and developing country diplomats. It has its advantages and disadvantages. When you deal with a delegation that comes from a developed country, of course you have first of all, they have a huge team. So in the negotiation, it could be me and another person, or at least like maximum three people, like trying to work on a topic. If you go to a developed country delegation, it's like 20 people. So they have like a person just dedicated for a specific kind of issue, and they keep changing. So if you want to speak to them about a specific article, they bring another person. So that's specialization. So that's a bit of a disadvantage towards you, that you have to deal with the whole thing. But also it's an advantage to us because we know the whole thing. So we are not in silos like when dealing with different issues. They do work in silos. So that's a bit of advantage. But in any case, like in the international world, there's no leveling of the playing field because you can really see the difference between how developing country delegations are trying to struggle to present their own positions and how developed countries could more easily do it. So in terms of what I have defended in the past, so I guess in the pandemic treaty negotiations, we have made a very strong effort in terms of transfer of technology of pandemic related products that we need to have in order to be better prepared for the next pandemic. That has been very difficult, but also has been a real challenge for Colombia, and especially particularly to me, because it's defending something that is very critical. And we don't want to be in the same position that we were in the COVID-19 pandemic. And another issue that we have to defend, and in terms of health, and just to focus on the health part of my career, is you will say that is a bit technical, but we work on a resolution for food fortification, and especially to address a problem that of spina bifida, that is a problem that little babies like. Babies when are conceived could have like a spine divided in two. So basically that's a very preventable congenital disease. And the way to do it is just to fortify a food to be able to for women to have folic acid before they get pregnant. So it's very technical, but at the end of the day, the purpose was to prevent babies being born with spina bifida because it's really painful. And it is really expensive to have that. Of course, they can have surgery, but it's really expensive. So babies being born in developing countries, like going through that pain and having to have that surgery is not always a possibility. So that tends to be a good sign thing for me because those are like concrete things that could have a real impact on people.
Yeah, I mean, it's so fascinating for me that you kind of have to take a load of a medical practitioner and try to convince in a dialogue which makes sense to both legally and also represent with so much passion and tension that you have to bear in terms of your country. Just out of curiosity, I'm sure many of these negotiations are still work in progress. Some of them are confidential. Maybe some of them are not passed through. Just going back with your example on the health issues with babies and trying to get it across and like trying to give a woman a better avenue to have folic acid. My question is just this just seems like an issue that a government internally has to deal with. For example, work on their funding to provide more available free medical support to women and provide them with either like medications related to folic acid or some kind of free preventive treatment in order to not foresee such an issue with their pregnancy. So what do you ask from another country in terms of a very specific support like such as an health exigency? So what is your negotiation borderline with another delegation?
Well, that's interesting, yeah, because like most of the conversations get stuck on not having sufficient what we call means of implementation. And means of implementation means funding and tech transfer. So developing countries don't have the same capabilities as developed countries to implement these kind of measures. But sometimes these are very cost-effective measures. So in terms, for example, of the food fortification, so to fortify food with folic acid is not that expensive as to have a surgery as soon as the baby is born. So it's kind of a balancing the health problems that we have with cost-effective measures and trying to that everything is on board. Since with health, we're dealing with a global common, such as like people are more familiar with the environment. So in terms of climate change, if not everybody stops polluting the air, like we're all gonna suffer climate change. So it's an effort by everybody. So it's not either one country doing it and the rest not doing it, like, because we all need to do it. It's the same thing in health because those are global commons. So if not everybody is doing this, so we will still have these kind of problems. And this goes along with the health emergencies. If we don't stop mpox in the African countries, like it will eventually spread throughout the world. That's what happened with COVID. So it's a balance in between cost-effective measures, a science-based approach, commitment to work towards, like in a multilateral way, through WHO, and of course, given the developing countries the means of implementation to be able to implement all these measures. And that is doable. It's difficult, but that is doable, and that's the way ha that health-related issues have been dealt with throughout the years.
Okay, wow, it's very interesting for me just listening to this. I feel so much pride just like taking in that you're doing this on behalf of a whole nation for 48 million people and subtly fighting I think a very modern battle that we would say these in today's time. You're pretty much going to a war field but in a very sophisticated sense, but having to put across a lot of strong issues. So, on the final bits of your career and decisions, I also know that you worked with the International Court of Justice as a lawyer because you have a PhD in public international law. You speak, I assume, five languages, and you're a diplomat. All of these are not good enough to be impressive. You also go on, and you had a stretch of a career where you represented the government again, dealing with laws of the sea in front of the International Court of Justice. For people who are listening, International Court of Justice is one of the highest form of judiciary institution that's available in the world today for dealing exclusively matters related to public international law. So, how was it being there, and do you have any fond memories of key challenges that you faced? How different is it from dealing, say, for example, with a private institution or like a massive institution like United Nations?
No, okay, no. Okay, so just for clarification, so I work for the ICJ cases as part of my government. So those are called the home team. So whenever an
Oh,
ICJ,
like the basketball team, like the redeem team, you guys are called the home team.
yeah, so we're called the home team. So whenever you had a case before the ICJ or an international tribunal, you need to set up a home team. And that is the team of the country that is dealing with the case, being a respondent or being a plaintiff. So I was part of that in some of the cases that Colombia had before the ICJ, and it was an amazing experience because I was like a very junior lawyer, just finished my LLM. I did my LLM in Leiden University, and I finished that, and I was involved in one of the cases. And Ecuador versus Colombia case. So it was on international environmental law. It was exhausting, it was challenging because it was a non-stop working. So we need to provide evidence. Of course, you have a team of legal experts, like very well-renowned experts in international law, like the big league figures. But they of course need the documents, evidence, and all the facts of the case being provided by the home team. So that's our thing, like try to build the case in terms of the interests of Colombia, and then we can work with the legal experts, like the renowned people in the international legal arguments. So it was amazing being representing your country in an ICJ case, like representing in terms of trying to build the case. And again, exhausting because when you're doing that, for example, during hearings, you never sleep. You never sleep at all. So it's like the hearings take place during a period of 3 weeks. And if you sleep 2 to 3 hours during a week, it's you feel lucky. So at the end of the day, it's a rush of adrenaline, of emotions, and then you get sick after the end of the hearings. But it's very interesting, and you learn a lot because going to the ICJ, you need to like be very, very well prepared. So to me, that was one of the best experiences that I have ever had, and I had the opportunity to do it because I was a diplomat.
And I also have to ask like final few questions, because now that we've exhaustively discussed as much as possible on your career growth and journey from being a young lawyer to being a diplomat to having legal experience, going to the highest court of the world. Not everybody has a trajectory of career like that. We all work towards just one of these aspects, but somehow in your life, you've almost made it to all of these aspects. So all of this does not come without certain motivation, certain kind of comfort. So I always ask my guest, and this is my most favorite part of the podcast, because more than the podcast itself, I personally benefit from these two questions, because I go back and read the book that my guest suggests, or listen to the or watch the movie that my guest suggests, and it changes my life, because this is something that potentially changed your life. So what is that one book that you believe that truly changed your life, and for the better or for the worse? It could not even be something that's so interestingly relevant to the scope of work you do, but something that was very close to your heart and you picked it up and you always remember something from the book, and you have to keep going thinking about it.
Okay, I don't think I have this type of book.
Well, even better.
but I have read so many interesting books in my life. So I was thinking about that question, and perhaps I don't have a book that had changed my life. I do have to say that I'm Catholic, so like the usual answer would be like the Bible and so on. But I have to say that that in terms of like this is a book that changed my life and like breaks my life into two. I don't have it. I do have some interesting books that I've read. So I was like rethinking and I like I didn't know that I liked it, but I like British literature. So I read Pride and Prejudice and I no, that's not the one. I wanted to say Wuthering Heights. So if people haven't read it, like that book by Emily Bronte, that was amazing to me. Like I couldn't stop reading it. So that's not a like a life-changing book, but to me that was like so very well written and you know the female power on it. I wouldn't imagine
Oh, it
that.
was life changing. You resonated with it, right? Like you felt it. So you
Yeah,
bought
I couldn't stop reading it. And the other books in Spanish is called El Olvido que Seremos, that it means the oblivion that we will be. And it's about how a son remembers his father that was murdered in Colombia because we had a very violent period in our country. So to me, that was very impactful because in any way, like we are alive because somebody remembers us. But if everybody forgets us, like we're basically dead. So to me, that was very, very interesting.
That's so lovely, Maria. Some of the things you say is like instantly touching me so deep, and it's so lovely that you said it, especially in Spanish. It was even more impactful. So the final question. So any movie that you love that picks you up like no other, or you can say a person that really inspired you. But yeah, it's an
Okay.
either or a question.
No, I am so I have very some like female lawyers that I have impacted me and they have made a very huge impact in the international legal sphere. I have like but those are in Latin names, so I remember my dean in Buenos Aires, Monica Pinto, so I really look forward to her. And but those are like personal names to me, or Jimena Nieto, but just personal names to me. But in terms of movies, so I'll be very childish. So I love Up, the Pixar movie. So to me, that was like a perfect example of what I would want from my life, and like second opportunities. And just the latest movie, I think it's called Poor Things with Emma Stone. I'm not sure if I'm mistakenly like I'm
No,
confusing
you're
them with.
right. Yeah, you're right. I watch it. I understand why you like it because it's very into health and all of that. So maybe you were in that portfolio and it made more
No,
sense.
but that was very good. So it's my female perspective too, and I didn't know that I have this kind of feminist approach, but I think I have it, and I really enjoyed that movie.
Well, I think this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast. I wish you all the very best, Maria, and it was very nice to have met you, very to have nice to have this conversation, and I truly took so many things away from me. Someday I truly hope and wish that I do something that is contributory to the level of public importance of public law. But those who are listening to it, I'm sure are truly inspired by you. And thank you again for coming on my podcast. And yeah.
No, thank you, Pooja, for the invitation.